From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, LBJ's secret White House tapes. We'll hear from presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's edited and annotated two volumes of transcribed LBJ tapes. Volume 2 is now out in paperback. We'll listen to tapes of LBJ talking with Jackie Kennedy shortly after JFK's assassination, getting advice from J. Edgar Hoover on how to thwart a homosexual scandal involving one of Johnson's aides, and discussing his fears that war in Vietnam was unwinnable with Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the early days of the folk rock group The Youngbloods. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police in Kenya say they're holding a group of suspects in yesterday's attacks against Israeli targets in Kenya. All but one of the detainees are foreigners. Yesterday's attack on a hotel killed 13 people along with three suicide bombers. A separate missile attack on an Israeli airliner failed to do any damage. The BBC's Ishbel Matheson reports from Mombasa.
The police investigation is now well underway. Among those arrested are a Spanish man and an American woman. They were detained hours after the suicide bombers struck. They had just checked out from a hotel close to the scene of the explosion. The hotel manager, Ben Wafula, said the couple claimed to be from Florida. The Kenyan police said they could be key witnesses. Among the others being held are six Pakistanis and several Somalis. A Kenyan police spokesman said they had originally been arrested early on Thursday for trying to enter the country illegally. It was only after the Mombasa attacks that they fell under suspicion.
The BBC's Ishbel Matheson reporting. Palestinians say Israeli soldiers arrested a leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades today in a West Bank town of Nablus. They say 28-year-old Majid Masri was a neighborhood leader of the group. The Al-Aqsa Brigades claimed responsibility yesterday for a shooting attack in northern Israel that left six Israelis dead. Earlier today, Israeli troops blew up the West Bank homes of the gunmen's families. Another gunman belonging to the group was killed today after he fired on a Jewish settlement in the Gaza Strip, wounding an Israeli and two foreign workers from Thailand. General Tommy Franks, the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, entertained troops during a brief visit to Bagram Air Base today. He also discussed plans to shift from combat operations to the reconstruction of the country. NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Bagram Air Base.
General Franks told journalists today that his troops still had a lot of work to do in Afghanistan.
While things seem to be okay for Afghanistan and maybe three-fourths of the country, we still have 20-30% of the area of the country where we see a lot of problems.
Attacks on U.S. forces here have increased this month, with one American soldier shot earlier this week by a sniper near the Pakistani border. But Franks denied a recent statement by his superior, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who said the U.S. military had lost momentum in Afghanistan. Instead, Franks said Washington was discussing a plan to focus U.S. military efforts on humanitarian projects to help rebuild the country. Ivan Watson, NPR News at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 35 points to close at 88.96. The Nasdaq lost 14 points to close at 14.78. This is NPR News. Shopping malls across the country are filled with customers looking for deep discounts the day after Thanksgiving, usually the busiest day of the holiday season. Georgia Public Radio's Mike Savage reports from one of the largest malls in the Southeast.
Located in North Georgia, the 2.1 million square foot Mall of Georgia is home to more than 170 retail shops. Mall spokesman Scott Higley says the start to the holiday shopping season appears to be the busiest in the 15 years that he has been at the mall. Higley believes consumers are making purchases earlier because this shopping season is only 3 weeks instead of 4 weeks.
So I've seen an awful lot of shopping bags in the mall and large bags. It looks like people are buying not just one item from a store, but several items. And maybe trying to get a lot of their shopping done a lot earlier in the season.
Merchants are hoping for strong sales early this holiday season. The National Retail Federation predicts only a 4% increase in holiday sales, the smallest increase in 5 years. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
Voice experts in Switzerland said today that an audio tape broadcast on an Arabic satellite TV station earlier this month may not be the voice of Osama bin Laden. The head of a Swiss voice research institute said comparisons with known recordings of bin Laden's voice led his experts to believe there was as much as a 60% chance the recording was fake. Experts at the CIA and the National Security Agency analyzed the tape earlier and said they believed the voice promising new terrorist attacks was that of the missing al-Qaeda leader. Because the tape mentions recent events, it was taken to be the first evidence in months that bin Laden is still alive. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology and to portray the lives of men and women engaged in scientific and technological pursuit.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to listen to some of the tapes that President Lyndon Johnson secretly made of his conversations with aides and officials, including tapes that reveal his fears about the escalating war in Vietnam.
The psychological impact of the Marines are coming is going to be a bad one, and I know enough to know that. And I know that every mother is going to say, oh, this is it. And I know that what we've done with these B-57s is just going to be scundy school stuff compared to the Marines. And all they're going to do is be a policeman. And damned if I don't know why we can't find some kind of policeman besides a Marine. Because a Marine is a guy that's got a dagger in his hand, and it's going to put the flag up.
That's LBJ speaking to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara in March 1965. Ever since Watergate, American presidents have known that if they taped their conversations, they could be used against them. Before Watergate, LBJ left a remarkable behind-the-scenes history of his presidency through the conversations, mostly phone calls, that he recorded on his hidden tape system. The system was intended to give Johnson a reliable record that could be used in his daily business. Today we'll hear an interview from our archives with presidential historian Michael Beschloss, who has edited and annotated 2 volumes of transcribed Johnson tapes. The second collection, covering 1964 through 65, has just come out in paperback. It's called Reaching for Glory. Beschloss is the author of 6 other books on the presidency, including The Conquerors, Roosevelt, Truman, and The Destruction of Hitler's Germany, which was published earlier this year. He's also a regular commentator on ABC News and The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and he's a trustee of the White House Historical Association. Michael Beschloss, welcome back to Fresh Air. Give us an overview of the period covered in the second volume of your book on the LBJ tapes.
Well, this is 1964 and 1965, and it was action-packed because it begins in the fall of 1964, where Lyndon Johnson was running against Barry Goldwater to become president in his own right. Then the second he's elected, he's dealing with Vietnam, civil rights, riots in the street, and also the Great Society, Medicare, and all those other programs. So you see a president dealing with all these things almost at once.
Let's start with a conversation between LBJ and Jacqueline Kennedy from December of 1963. At this point, she's still living in the executive mansion with her children. Set the context for this.
Well, this is right after John Kennedy's assassination, and Mrs. Kennedy, as you might imagine, you'll hear on the tape, is absolutely distraught. Her voice is almost otherworldly. She's not sleeping. She's, needless to say, terribly depressed. And Johnson calls her up. And on one level, Johnson is being wonderful because he almost flirts with her. He's trying to make her feel better. But at the same time, as always with Johnson, he's got a political motive. And the political motive is he felt illegitimate as president. He had suddenly come in after John Kennedy was assassinated in his whole home state, and Johnson felt that the best thing he could do for himself politically was to keep Jackie Kennedy as close to him as possible. So he keeps on calling her up, making her feel better, but also asking her, after she leaves the White House, to come back, be photographed with him. He even says that he wants John and Caroline to be his surrogate children, and she recoils from this.
Well, let's hear one of the early conversations in this series. This is from December 2nd of 1963.
Mr. President?
I just wanted you to know you were loved, and by so many ends, so much.
Oh, Mr.
I'm
President,
one of them.
I tried. I didn't dare bother you again, but I got Kenny O'Donnell over here to give you a message. If he ever saw you, did he give it to you yet?
No.
About my letter?
No.
That was waiting for me last night?
Listen, sweetie, now, first thing you got to learn, you got some things to learn, and one of them is that you don't bother me. You give me strength.
But I wasn't going to send you in one more letter, and I was
don't
just scared
anything.
You'd answer.
Don't send me anything. You just come over and put your arm around me. That's all you do. When you haven't got anything else to do, let's take a walk. Let's walk around the backyard and just let me tell you how much you mean to all of us and how we can carry on if you give us a little strength.
But you know what I want to say to you about that letter? I know how rare a letter is in a president's handwriting. Do you know that I've got more in your handwriting than I do in Jack's now?
My mother and my wife and my sisters and you females got a lot of courage that we men don't have, and so we have to rely on you and depend on you, and you got something to do. You got the president relying on you, and this is not the first one you had. So there are not many women, you know, run around with a good many presidents. So you just bear that in mind, and you got the biggest job of your life.
He ran around with two presidents. That's what they'll say about me. Okay, anytime.
Jackie Kennedy sounds to be alternating between crying and laughing in that conversation.
Yes, and you could even hear Johnson making those kiss sounds at the end. And that's what she was feeling because, you know, she was devastated. Her husband had been murdered in her arms in Dallas. And at the same time, she appreciated the fact that LBJ was trying to buck her up. And they had had a pretty good relationship when Lyndon Johnson was vice president. Johnson said, "She was the only one in the Kennedy White House who treated me like a human being."
Now, later, Johnson offers her an ambassadorship, which she declines. Why did he want to give her one? Why did she decline?
He kept on worrying that she was going to be turned against Johnson by her brother-in-law, Robert Kennedy, whom she adored. And he was absolutely right in worrying about this, because during the time that tape we just heard was made, RFK was saying to Jackie, "He's going to use you. Be careful. Don't get taken in." And so Johnson felt that the way to keep her on the reservation would be to give her a job in the administration, perhaps ambassador to Mexico or ambassador to France. Both of these she turned down.
My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just published the second volume of his edited transcriptions of the LBJ tapes. This volume is called Reaching for Glory, White House Tapes 1964 to 1965. Let's move on to a tape from September of 1964. This is during the period where LBJ is campaigning for the presidency against Barry Goldwater. And Goldwater has been attacking LBJ, and LBJ wants to get back at him. This is a tape with William White, a syndicated newspaper columnist. Tell us about what this tape is about.
Well, White was probably the columnist who was closest to Johnson. He was almost hagiographic about Johnson. And what Johnson is doing is he wants White to take confidential FBI information that Johnson has gotten from J. Edgar Hoover and get White to publish it. This is information that is very damaging, he thinks, to Barry Goldwater. And Johnson wants to sling this mud in a way that will not let people know that White's source is the president and the FBI.
So let's hear LBJ's 1964 conversation with William White, in which LBJ is trying to get even with Goldwater.
"Well, we got a bunch of goddamn thugs here taking us on. Now, this Goldwater's talk about morality, when if we wanted to deal in morality, what we could show on that guy. I got the record in front of me where his 89-year-old mother is drawing a tax deduction from the Goldwater stores that are owned by Associated Dry Goods for $4,900 a year, and she's too damn old to even get to the store. And when they raised hell, he agreed to reduce it to $1,200, so just let them take a tax deducted pension of $100.
Yeah.
And then they talk to me about morality.
I know that. I agree with that.
He's lined up with every one of these gambler thugs. This B.O. and the whole outfit flew him back and forth to Nevada, played with him all the time, had him in his home, all that kind of stuff. Just unthinkable. But we haven't brought any of that out, and I hope we don't have to. But I'm tired of him talking to me about morality."
So did the information about Goldwater's mother drawing a tax deduction from the Goldwater stores ever get out? And what about the allegations of Goldwater being involved with gambler thugs? Did LBJ ever do anything with that?
It was published, but people were not terribly interested, as well they might not have been, because it wasn't really very serious or reliable information. But it shows you a lot about Johnson, because this was a time when Barry Goldwater and his running mate William Miller were saying the problem with LBJ is he may have taken over decently after the Kennedy assassination, and you may agree with his policies, but they said this is an immoral man. He doesn't have character. And Johnson worried about this because he was running at this point about 30 or 40 points ahead of Goldwater in the presidential campaign. He thought that the one thing that could bring him down would be if voters concluded that Johnson was immoral. This is why he was so desperate to sort of release stuff on Goldwater that would make Goldwater look as if he was the one who was immoral.
My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. The second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's secret White House tapes has just come out in paperback. It's called Reaching for Glory. Beschloss is also the author of The Conquerors, Roosevelt, Truman, and the Destruction of Hitler's Germany. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. The second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's secret White House tapes has just come out in paperback. Now, in your new collection of LBJ tapes, you also deal with some of the scandals or potential scandals, sex scandals of his administration. And one of them has to do with somebody in the administration who is gay and closeted. He's discovered, and this is, for the time, 1964, a potentially really explosive scandal. The person in question was Walter Jenkins. Who was he, and what was he alleged to have done?
Well, it's a pretty amazing part of the book. Walter Jenkins was Lyndon Johnson's closest aide in the White House, had worked for him since 1939, was a devout Catholic, had six children, but, as you say, at the same time, had another life that was secret. He was a closeted gay. And this was 1964. It was something he was very ashamed of. And the result was that in mid-October of 1964, just a few weeks before the election, Jenkins was at a party in Washington that was given for the opening of new offices for Newsweek magazine. Jenkins got drunk. He went over to the YMCA a few blocks away, which was at that point a well-known place where gay people could meet. And he was arrested for having sex with another man in the men's room downstairs. He was hauled into the police station, paid his fine, and amazingly enough, he went back to the White House and began working again, didn't tell anyone what had happened, and that did not become known. About a week later, there was a Republican operative who discovered this, gave the word to various newspapers, and then what happened was Lyndon Johnson himself was notified that, to his shock, his closest aide not only had been arrested, but arrested just a couple of weeks before the election. So since Johnson was worried that Goldwater could only win by pinning on him a charge of immorality, Johnson thought he was suddenly vulnerable because in those times people might have charged that here was someone very close to the president who might have been compromised.
So I'd like to play a conversation that LBJ had with Billy Graham on October 20th of 1964. And this is while LBJ is still reeling from this potential scandal. And there's a lot of other problems that he's having. What are the other problems?
He's trying to deal with, needless to say, beating Barry Goldwater. But the other part of it is that Jenkins, at this point, has been hospitalized and the scandal has somewhat passed, but he's worried that there will be other scandals. He's heard that the Republicans are looking for other people in his midst who either might be gay or have marital problems or that they might be able to pin something on LBJ.
So here's LBJ and Billy Graham in a phone conversation in October 20th, 1964.
Hello, Billy. How are you, my friend?
Well, God bless you. I was telling Bill that last night I couldn't sleep, and I got on my knees and prayed for you that the Lord would just give you strength.
I told my sweet wife last night we got mental telepathy. I said if I didn't think I'd embarrass him, I'd say, please, dear Lord, I need you more than ever did in my life. I got the Russians on one side of me taking air, the Chinese are dropping bombs around, contaminating the atmosphere, and the best man I ever knew had a stroke and a disease hit him, and I've been tied in here with my cabinet all day, and I'd have him just make him come down and spend Sunday with me.
Well, bless your heart. I'll be glad to. I told Bill that there were two things. One was I just felt terribly impressed to tell you to slow down a little bit. I've been awfully worried about you physically.
Well.
And then the second thing, you've got this election, in my opinion, wrapped up, and you've got it wrapped up big. There's no doubt in my mind about that. You know, when Jesus dealt with people with moral problems, like dear Walter had, and I was telling Bill I wanted to send my love and sympathy to him.
Thank you.
He always dealt tender, always.
Yeah.
I know the weaknesses of men, and the Bible says we're all sinners, and we all involved one way or another, and I just hope if you have any contact with him, you'll just give him my love and understand.
That'll mean more than anything. Come down here Saturday evening and have dinner with us, and let's have a quiet visit, and maybe have a little service Sunday morning in the White House itself.
Very interesting conversation, Billy Graham and LBJ in 1964. My guest, Michael Beschloss, is a presidential historian. His new book is Volume 2 of LBJ Tapes. It's called Reaching for Glory. Whatever did happen with the Walter Jenkins story? What kind of impact did it have on LBJ? How was it resolved?
Turned out to have no effect on the campaign because Johnson was very lucky. Within 48 hours after the revelation, a number of things happened to take the news away. There was an ouster of the British government, an ouster of the Soviet government of Nikita Khrushchev. The World Series was on, plus the Chinese fired off their first atomic weapon. The other thing was that Johnson was able to get the campaign away from this question of morality, and one way he did it, we've just heard, is by inviting Billy Graham to the White House, which he was not doing just because he wanted a little bit of moral advice. He knew that it was going to be very helpful for a president who was under the attack of people saying that you're immoral to have Billy Graham, the best-known evangelist in the United States, staying in the White House and essentially giving his blessing to President Johnson.
You know, but at the same time, there's this story breaking that, you know, Walter Jenkins, a close aide to LBJ, had a homosexual relationship. There's rumors that the Republicans are going to start spreading photos of LBJ in a compromising position with a woman who wasn't his wife. What happened with that?
That was one of the worries that Johnson had. Just about 2 weeks before the election, George Reedy, his press secretary, walked in and said, there's a rumor that there's a photograph of you in a compromising position with this woman who lives in Louisiana and who does not live the proper sort of life. That's my language and not his. And Johnson was terrified that something like this might happen just before the election, an October surprise that would hand the election to Goldwater.
Did that ever happen?
It didn't happen, but what you hear and read in the book, these conversations, you know, the last few days before the election, Johnson was terrified that it would. He was on the telephone all the time to J. Edgar Hoover saying, make sure this does not happen and cause my defeat.
Well, speaking of Hoover, you include a tape with J. Edgar Hoover, and I think at this point LBJ is worried that somebody else in his cabinet is going to be exposed as gay. And there, Hoover and LBJ are having a talk about, well, how do you know if somebody's gay or not? How can you spot them? Do you want to say anything else about this conversation before we hear it?
This is Johnson. You know, he always operated at about 10 different levels. And in the one we're about to hear, the top level is he's just asking his FBI director, you know, how you spot a secret homosexual in your entourage, which in those horrible prehistoric times would have been politically damaging. But at the same time, Johnson knows privately of the rumors that Hoover himself is gay, so in a way he's sort of playing with him by saying to Hoover, tell me, how do you spot a secret homosexual?
Okay, let's hear the conversation. LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, recorded on October 31st, 1964.
Now, we took over that investigation yesterday.
Yeah.
They said that this particular man had been under surveillance and that they were going to explode this bomb today. Now, the only person I know of who's been under surveillance by any agency has been this man over in the Navy Department.
No, I read that. What they said was that They raised the question the way he combed his hair or the way he did something else, but they had no act of his or he had done nothing.
It was just the suspicion that his mannerisms and so forth were such that they were suspicious.
Yeah, he worked for me for 4 or 5 years, but he wasn't even suspicious to me. But I guess you're going to have to teach me something about this stuff.
Well, you know, I often wonder what the next crisis is going to be.
I'll swear I can't recognize him. I don't know anything about
it. It's a thing that you just can't tell. Sometimes, just like in the case of this poor fellow Jack and Three,
yeah.
There was no indication in any way.
No.
I knew him pretty well, and Deloach did also, and there was no suspicion, no indication. There are some people who walk kind of funny and so forth that you might kind of think are a little bit off, off or maybe queer.
What is the historic value of listening back to that, Michael Beschloss, of hearing the head of the FBI and the president of the United States speculating on how can you tell, as Hoover put it, if somebody's queer?
Well, one thing is to show how far we have come from those times, and it's a good thing, too. The other thing is it shows the way that business was oftentimes done by presidents in those days, which was, if you've got a problem, if a scandal threatens you, you call the FBI and quash it.
How far have we come since that time? Seems to me there's still...
still a lot of ways to go, but that was a time where if you appointed a gay man or a gay woman to a prominent place in your administration, that would have been politically very hard to do. Thank God things have changed since then.
Well, as recently in the Clinton administration, there were still people shot down who never got their position because they were gay.
Yes, but in the Johnson times, it wouldn't even got as far as a president making the appointment to be shot down.
Right. Getting back to Walter Jenkins, who was forced out of the LBJ administration because he was found having a gay relationship, a closeted relationship, Jenkins was replaced as special assistant to the president by Bill Moyers.
Bill Moyers, and we know him now, of course, as the television commentator, but got his start not only in the Johnson White House, but actually working for Lyndon Johnson's television station down in Austin.
Presidential historian Michael Beschloss, Reaching for Glory, the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's secret White House tapes, has just come out in paperback. There's also an audio version of the book. Beschloss will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Book Magazine, in the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. And Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides, providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear LBJ confiding his fears about the war in Vietnam to his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, as we continue our conversation with presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's edited 2 volumes of LBJ's secret White House tapes. And Ed Ward remembers the early days of the Youngbloods.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with presidential historian Michael Beschloss. His second collection of Lyndon Johnson's secretly recorded tapes, called Reaching for Glory, has just come out in paperback. It covers 1964 and 65. There's also an audio version of the book using the actual tape of LBJ's conversations with cabinet members, aides, and officials, made on his hidden recording system in the Oval Office. Beschloss is also the author of The Conquerors, Roosevelt, Truman, and the Destruction of Hitler's Germany, as well as six other presidential histories. One of the things LBJ was known for was having a big ego, an ego that was sometimes bruised, and I think we can hear what that was like in a conversation that he had with his advisor, Edwin Weisel, after LBJ won the election against Barry Goldwater. And winning wasn't enough. He was complaining that the TV commentators were saying that he only won because people saw him as the lesser of two evils. What should we listen for in this tape?
This was a guy who had an awful lot to be thankful for, a wife who loved him, children, friends. He was president of the United States, which he had always wanted to do, but it was never enough. He was always unhappy. And the moment that really brought it home to me was election night, 1964. He's elected by just about the largest landslide in history. And I said to myself, aha, I'll finally hear this guy actually happy. And you listen to him election night, and the first half of the night, he's complaining that Robert Kennedy, who was just elected senator from New York, had not thanked him enough in his acceptance speech. And the second half of the night, he's complaining that the TV commentators are saying this was just an anti-Goldwater election, not a pro-Johnson victory. And so in the tape that we're about to hear, you hear him complaining to this close lawyer friend of his, Ed Weisel, that we've got to do something about that.
Well, let's hear the tape recorded in November of 1964.
We don't have any propaganda machine, and we don't have anybody that can get out our stuff. Now, Ray Moley started this story that just voting against Goldwater, and they didn't like either one of us, and that Johnson didn't have any rapport, and he didn't have any style, and he was a buffoon, and he was full of corn. And every place I went in this campaign, I went to 49 states with Lady Bird and two girls. I was 44 myself. I had the biggest crowd that ever had before, and I got the biggest vote anybody ever got before, and I had the greatest affection that had ever been demonstrated before, and the greatest loyalty, and more big businessmen, and more labor men, and more Negroes, and more Jews, and more ethnic groups, more everybody. But they say, oh, that doesn't amount to anything. So the Bobby Kennedy group, they kind of put out this stuff, and the little Kennedy folks around there had nobody, and nobody loved Johnson. And they're going to have it built up by January that I didn't get any mandate at all, that I was just the lesser of two evils, and people didn't care. And now I think that you've got to point out that Dick Daley says that he figured we'd run 750,000 in Chicago. Now we're going to run 850 to 9, and we saved the governor, and we run over a million in the state. It's the greatest candidate that he's ever seen, the greatest political candidate. And I think you got to quote him, because that's what he told me a dozen times. I had twice the crowd Eisenhower ever had. Now, they wrote about Eisenhower for 8 years, but they've never written one word about us. And they've got to say something about the auditorium at Austin, Texas being filled at 2:30 in the morning just waiting to see me, the people that knew me best, and that they voted for me 6 and 8 to 1 in my home boxes, that Miller was losing, and the love and the affection they had for 30 years. Now, all they write about is not love and affection. They write, well, the lesser two evils, corn pone, Southern. Well, now let's get busy on this, Eddie, before they ruin us and make a Harding out of us. We've got to be thinking what we do about this Attorney General now. We've got to get the ablest, strongest, finest, most respectable man that we can get, because they want to make a bunch of crooks out of us.
Well, it sounds like he not only wants to win, he cares about his image.
Not only cares about his image, you know, if you heard this, Terry, and you didn't know what this was, you'd think this was the talk of someone who just lost the election.
Right.
He's angry, he's upset, he's suspicious. This is just after he's gotten the biggest landslide in modern times, and he sounds miserable. And this was a guy who was much too suspicious for his own good, and as we will hear, as time went on, it only got worse.
Your book reveals the story behind the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. That's the resolution that gave LBJ the authority to fight the war. This was in 1964. What did you learn about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution from the LBJ secret tapes?
Well, you know, that resolution was August of 1964, and Johnson had gone to Congress after there was, he thought at the time, an attack on an American vessel in the Gulf of Tonkin. That evening, August 64, Johnson, as he says, bombed hell out of the North Vietnamese. And then he went to Congress and said, give me a resolution that allows me to repel any further such attacks. Almost everyone in the House and Senate voted for it. That was what Johnson used as his congressional basis to fight the whole war in Vietnam. He never went back for another resolution, certainly never asked Congress for a declaration of war. And what the book shows from these tapes is that as early as a month after the Gulf of Tonkin incident took place, Johnson realized that there had never been any North Vietnamese attack on American vessel at all, so it made even the basis for the whole Vietnam War even more flimsy, but he did not tell the public.
My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. The second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's secret White House tapes has just come out in paperback. It's called Reaching for Glory. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. The second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's secret White House tapes has just come out in paperback. It covers the period of 1964 through 65. There was a lot of speculation while LBJ was president about what would have happened in Vietnam had President Kennedy lived. Would we have gotten in deeper? Would he have pulled out sooner? And LBJ was worried that some people were saying that LBJ was blaming the war on Kennedy, and he was putting it at making it his responsibility. And LBJ was denying that he was trying to lay the blame on Kennedy. And he talked about that in a conversation with his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, in January of 1965. What should we be listening for in this tape?
Well, I put this one in the book because what it shows is that Johnson felt that Kennedy was not only John Kennedy committed to defend South Vietnam, but Johnson in January of 65 felt that if he betrayed that commitment, the person who would go after him would be the late president's brother, Robert Kennedy, because in January of 65, Robert Kennedy was not a dove, but a hawk. And so LBJ felt that if he pulled out of Vietnam, one of the big penalties he'd pay would be that RFK would make his life miserable and say, you betrayed my brother's commitment.
Let's hear this recording between McNamara and LBJ in January of 65.
They have these little parties out at Georgetown. Bill Moyers tells me they had a party last night, and Joe Alsop called up very excited today and said that he and Kraft and all Evans and the Kennedy crowd decided that I had framed up to get to Armed Services, the Senate, to call McCone to put the Vietnam War on Kennedy's tomb, and that I had a conspiracy going on to show that it was Kennedy's immaturity and poor judgment that originally led us into this thing, that got us involved, and that his execution of it had brought havoc to the country.
Well,
now, of course, I have never laid any blame on Kennedy.
No.
Have you ever heard me blame Kennedy for anything?
Absolutely not. No, I've mentioned this to Jackie several times. I've been very impressed by your attitude on that. Well, the president was alive, as a matter of fact.
I may not have anything else in my life, but I got loyalty.
Yeah.
And I think that if any of this crowd is in your vicinity or in your associates' vicinity, I think what you ought to say to them is this, that I assume full responsibility buy everything and don't ask anybody else to take it, including President Kennedy. And during his lifetime, whatever he did, I spar. And in his death, it's my complete responsibility, and I don't shove it off on anybody else.
LBJ and Robert McNamara recorded in January of 1965. And Michael Beschloss, at this point, is Johnson starting to think that Bobby Kennedy is becoming an enemy instead of an ally?
As early as the beginning of Johnson's elected presidency after the election of 1964, Johnson figured that RFK wanted to do him in and also probably run against him for president in 1968.
And what happened to their relationship as time went by?
It went only south, Terry. Kennedy, within a few months after this tape, came out against the Vietnam War and began thinking seriously about running against Johnson in 1968. And, of course, RFK finally did in March of 1968, only a couple of weeks before LBJ pulled out.
Let's hear one more conversation between LBJ and Robert McNamara, this one recorded in June of 65, in which LBJ is confessing some of his fears about the war.
It's going to be difficult for us to, very long, prosecute effectively a war that far away from home with the divisions that we have here, and particularly the potential divisions. And that's really had me concerned for a month, and I'm very depressed about it because I see no program from either defense or state that gives me much hope of doing anything except just praying and gasping to hold on during monsoon and hope they'll quit. I don't believe they're ever going to quit, and I don't see how we have any way of either a plan for victory militarily or diplomatically.
Well, that's as early as 65, and he thinks it's pretty hopeless. Michael Beschloss, what did you learn about how LBJ managed the war in Vietnam and what his role was in the execution of the war?
Well, the saddest revelation was that as he began the war, that he didn't feel that we could win, that there wasn't a way to win, and that he did not tell that to people. And one of the things I worried about when I was working on this book is that American vets are going to hear this and their families are, and what are they going to say? They're going to say, you know, our loved one or I was sent to Vietnam to fight and probably lose my life in a war that the president never felt that we had a chance to win. He was sending us into harm's way. Why did he do this? And so I think the basic thing you have to say is I think Lyndon Johnson was a good man with wonderful intentions in many ways, but one of the most basic things an American president should never do is send American human beings into harm's way while in private without telling them, thinking that they have no chance to win.
There's also things in your book about the civil rights movement. And I thought we could listen to a conversation that LBJ had with George Wallace, who was then governor of Alabama. This is March 18th of 1965. And at this time, LBJ was trying to pressure George Wallace to speed black registration and desegregate the schools. And George Wallace was saying that LBJ had no authority in that area. Tell us more about what was happening at this time between LBJ and George Wallace.
Well, I was so glad to put this in the book because here's one of the great moments in history that you're so glad you have a tape of, because this is the time of the Selma to Montgomery March, and Johnson is trying to get George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama, to be at least as benign as possible and not interfere, and if possible, to protect the marchers. But he didn't trust Wallace. So what you hear him doing is trying to push Wallace to give these marchers some protection, and you hear Wallace trying to protect himself politically.
Okay, this is LBJ and Governor George Wallace in March of 1965.
We got hundreds of bearded beefsteaks in front of my capital now, and the point I'm making is that it looks like the group coming here with the language they're using. They made a speech on the streets of our city 2 days ago, and James Foreman suggested in front of all the nuns and priests that if anybody went in the cafe and they wouldn't serve them, they'd kick the f***ing legs of the tables off. They're all making that kind of intemperate remarks and inflames people, you know. But I'm asking people to stay away from this highway, to use your superior discipline, and I'm going to do everything that I can. But now, all I want to say quite frankly is that they've been stirred up by a lot of things, and of course, I know you don't want anything to happen that looks like a revolution.
Maybe by all of us saying to them, let's have the march, let's get it over as soon as we can, let's everybody stay at home at will, and let's don't, when you talk about a revolution, that really upsets us all. And,
well, let me say this, Mr. President, you have some revolutionaries down.
Well, I know that. I understand that.
But, and of course, if I was a revolutionary, I probably could invite 250,000 people to come help us, but of course, I don't want anything like that at all.
I know.
I don't want it to get hurt. But the reason I don't want to be in the position of enemies is that I'm asking for federal troops. We have ministers down here that walk up and scratch the patrolman on the hands, you know, and they turn it around. They were preached yesterday, asked all the patrolmen what their wives were doing. We reckon some of their friends could have dates with their wives, you know, trying to provoke them, those kind of things.
I think it'd be better if you called up the guard in the service of the state, and I just approved it and gave some advisors with them rather than our doing it. And if the situation deteriorated, and if you're a highway patrolman or going back to the highways to take care of the drunk drivers and things like that, and you've got this group of that's coming, and the highway's moving, and the tourist court's filling up. If you call up your guard, I'll put the best people we've got to work right with them, and our people here applaud the conduct of the guard the last time they had them. They think you're all right, and we'll just we'll have sitting back alerted, ready for whatever help you need these others. And I think I just say that, and I think I just ought to say it. I'm asking people in the country not to let this thing get out of hand.
Why did LBJ want Wallace to call the National Guard instead of LBJ doing it?
Because Johnson knew that if it looked as if the feds were coming in, that would hurt the civil rights movement. He wanted Wallace to do it. And, of course, Wallace, because he was against civil rights, he was throwing the hot potato back to Johnson, saying, you do it. You know, Terry, this is really Lyndon Johnson at his best in this conversation, because this was a guy who, in the pit of his stomach, what he cared most about was civil rights and poverty, wanted to help the poor. That's what he wanted to devote his presidency to instead of Vietnam. And on the civil rights side, we were all really lucky to have this Southern president in office who was the one who was bringing the civil rights revolution to America. You know, even listening to him talking to Wallace, you notice his accent gets a little bit more Southern. He speaks to Wallace in his own language. That made it a little bit easier.
Michael Beschloss, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Me too. Thank you very much, Terry.
Michael Beschloss is a presidential historian. I spoke with him last year after the publication of the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's Secret White House Tapes. It's called Reaching for Glory, and it covers 1964 and 65. It's just come out in paperback. There's also an audio version of the book. Beschloss is also the author of The Conquerors, Roosevelt, Truman, and the Destruction of Hitler's Germany, and six other presidential histories. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the Youngbloods. This is Fresh Air. Our rock historian, Ed Ward, says that the Youngbloods were the second most important folk rock band of the late 60s, the first being the Byrds. With two of the greatest voices of the time, Jesse Colin Young and Jerry Corbett, the Youngbloods created some of the finest music of the day. Music historian Ed Ward tells us how they got together.
The Youngbloods came into being sometime in 1966 when Jesse Colin Young, who'd been around the Boston folk scene, and Jerry Corbett, a New York folkie, recruited drummer Joe Bauer and a keyboard player named Lowell Levenger III, but who called himself Banana, to form a band. In a short while, they became the house band at the Café Agogo in Greenwich Village, and they were perhaps the first band ever to demand total artistic control as part of the record contract they inevitably signed. The reason they commanded such respect was simple. Jesse knew great songwriters and had already recorded some of their best songs. He didn't mind re-recording them with a band either.
4 in the morning and the water is pouring down. Stove don't work and the baby has just left town. I'm lying on my back cause it just ain't.
Four in the Morning was by Robin Ramelli and had been a centerpiece of Jesse's solo act for years. But the band wasn't afraid to tackle other songs, which had been done by plenty of other people. The Other Side of This Life was a Fred Neil song recorded by, among others, the Jefferson Airplane, but nobody had attacked it with quite the ferocity of the Youngbloods. However, it was another much-recorded number for which they're probably best remembered these days.
Love is but a song we sing, fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring. Oh, make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing, and you may not know why. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together.
Oddly, Get Together by the ill-fated West Coast songwriter Dino Valenti wasn't a hit when it was first released in the Summer of Love, 1967. It only got to 62 on the pop charts and then disappeared. The band wasn't particularly concerned. There were a lot of good songs out there, and they'd started writing them themselves.
Shoot your dice and have your fun, sugar baby. Shoot your dice and have your fun. Run like your mama when the police come. Yeah, sugar baby. Oh my, sugar baby.
Sugar Babe, Jesse's rewrite of a traditional tune, wound up in the soundtrack of Antonioni's film Zabriskie Point and was one of the first songs to point in the direction of country rock, which was just emerging. But all was not well with the Youngbloods, and during the recording of their second album, Earth Music, Jerry Corbett left the band to go solo. Banana took over guitar and live performances, but the loss of the magic vocal blend was sad. But there were more changes underway. The three remaining Youngbloods relocated to rural Marin County, north of San Francisco, and, inspired by the view of a hill in the vicinity, made an album called Elephant Mountain. Oddly, moving to hippie paradise stimulated Jesse's depressive tendencies, resulting in one of the band's greatest moments.
darkness, be my pillow. Take my hand and let me sleep in the coolness of your shadow, in the silence of your deep darkness. Darkness, hide my yearning for the things that cannot be. Keep my mind from constant turning toward the things I cannot see now. Things I cannot see now. Things I cannot see.
Needless to say, that didn't do so well on the charts, despite David Lindley's amazing fiddle. But after it sank, the National Council of Christians and Jews took Get Together as its TV ad song, and the Youngbloods' two-year-old record rocketed to number 5. Hot like never before, the band negotiated another first, a contract with Warner Brothers Records, which allowed them their own label, Raccoon. That's another story, though, and we'll have to wait for those records to be reissued before I can tell it.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. A compilation CD called Get Together, The Essential Youngbloods, is on BMG Heritage. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
I was sitting, picking on a ragtime tune. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. You said no crying on a rainy afternoon. Let me tell you, crazy is the way you're gonna be. Giving folks the opportunity.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Thompson talks about the new edition of his biographical Dictionary of Film. It's a lively and opinionated collection of entries about actors and directors. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.